forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, already July 19th. Mostly cloudy and warm. Today's high 83. Rain moving in tonight. Maybe showers and thunderstorms. The low is 68. Friday, rain showers likely. Maybe some more thunderstorms. Tomorrow's high 78. Here are the new numbers just in. Wind from the east at 5. Humidity 75%. 71 degrees in Kenosha. It is 67 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night, the Racine Theater Guild is going to be opening its newest production, its summer show, and it is a show that all kinds of people are very, very excited about. It's a play called Peter and the Starcatcher, and it is based on a very, very popular novel for young people called Peter and the Starcatchers, which is something of a prequel to the familiar stories revolving around the characters of Peter Pan. And we all know that story very well. And if you are of a certain age, you almost certainly know Peter and the Starcatcher because it has been such a popular book for so many people. But for someone like me, I'm way too old to know this book directly, except just sort of by reputation. So I'm excited to see this production at the Theater Guild and to find out where this intriguing character of Peter Pan came from. Joining us for these first few minutes of the morning show are Kara Ernst Schalk, who is the director of this production, and we have two of the actors joining us as well. Evan Klinkhammer, who is portraying the central role of Peter, and Nick Ciccarelli, who is the bad guy in this production, or one of the bad guys. He portrays Blackstache. So we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Good morning.
So Kara, explain how this assignment's come your way. You've directed quite a few of the summer shows, and I suspect you sort of get first crack at them if it's something that you relish the opportunity. What made you say that you wanted to direct this particular play?
I have a huge love of The Boy Who Never Grew Up. About 24 years ago, I played him on the Guild stage, and that started my love. I tend to do the summer shows, as you said, but this one kind of fell in my lap as far as all the stars aligned. And I had a chance to spend my summer with him again, and it's been really fun to see different sides of the characters that I've always known and loved.
Right, and that you have yourself portrayed. In fact, how much did you portray Peter Pan on the stage? It was more than one run, wasn't it?
I only had one. Of the 3 years, I did one of the runs, but
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know that is a big part of the Theater Guild's own history, and like you just said, part of your own history as well. Did you know this novel before getting acquainted with this play specifically?
I didn't. I was really familiar with local productions of the play that they were going on around me, but my schedule never allowed me to go and see them, unfortunately. And every time one went flying by me, I was like, oh, I missed it again. And then I saw it on our play reading committee that they had approved it for this year, and I was thrilled because I said, finally, I'll get to see it. Well, I've seen it. And it's been a wonderful way to spend the summer.
Right. And I know you have an absolutely fantastic cast and a really nice mix of Theater Guild veterans, I mean, kind of all stars and some newcomers really new to this stage. And I understand that, I mean, just lots of talented people came out. So it must be the kind of work that gets a lot of actors excited.
Yes, we have at the Guild, we are blessed to have so many talented people on stage behind the scenes. They come out in droves, and this is probably one of the larger groups to come out and audition for a summer show, which was really exciting, and it really shows the love for the piece and these characters. And again, it's really fun to work with people that I've worked with before, and then obviously bringing new people into the Guild, getting some new energy and some new talent on stage is always fun for us and the audience.
Fantastic. I want to find out from each of our two actors their acquaintance with this work ahead of even auditioning for it. Let's start with Nick Ciccarelli, sure, who is on the faculty at Tremper High School, yes, down in Kenosha, doing theater there. So, Nick, what did you know about this play and or novel before you even found out that the Theater Guild was doing this?
Sure. I have never read the novel, but I knew that the novel existed, primarily through middle school teachers that I know whose students had read it. And I've seen the production a number of times, and I've read the production just as possibility maybe to direct one day. Hmm. So I've seen it at Bradford High School, and then I've seen a production that Middleton High School as well produced. So I was pretty familiar with – and those two shows were actually very different in their presentation as well. So I liked that it's adaptable – to different forms of direction as well. Mm. It's an intriguing script where it is open to interpretation, the way it's presented.
I assume you weren't auditioning for the role of Peter. I assume that wasn't
no,
your highest goal.
That ship has sailed, yeah.
Did you have in mind that it would be especially fun to play Blackstache, or didn't you particularly care? Did you just want to be part of this?
I just wanted to be a part of it. I've seen a number of Guild productions. I've always been impressed by Guild productions, and so in the summer, I have some free time on my hands for once, so I thought I'd give it a shot because I liked the script and I've always liked what they produced here, so I thought I'd give it a, you know, try it, and it worked out.
Fantastic. We'll talk more about your character in a second and find out what it's like to play a bad guy that everybody boos. But let's talk first to Evan Klinkhammer. What did you know about this novel and or play? Are you the right age that you actually encountered this maybe in grade school or middle school?
I remember in elementary school seeing some of my friends read it. I personally never read it, but I was familiar with what it was and what like the general plot was. I knew it was a Peter Pan prequel. So up to my audition, I kind of did my research on the show. I looked in, I read like the synopsis on the story. I watched a couple different performances of it just to see the different interpretations of it. And it's definitely a show that you can do a lot of different ways. You can do a lot of different things with it, and it seemed really interesting.
Right. And going into auditions, were you hoping that you might possibly be Peter Pan?
No, I was just hoping to get into the show. Yeah. I was like, I just wanted to be involved. I definitely was not expecting to get Peter when I got my phone call. I was very surprised.
Cool. Well, we'll certainly want to talk about that intriguing character as well. Kara, maybe you could summarize, to some extent at least, the basic story of this prequel to the well-known story of Peter Pan. I should preface this by saying that I read the synopsis on Wikipedia, and I couldn't. It's one of the lengthiest, most detailed synopsis I've ever read in my life. So I was left kind of with my head reeling. But it looks like an absolutely amazing, magical story. But I'm hoping you can kind of sum it up.
It's a very challenging script. It actually took me about 3 reads and a lot of plotting to get my head around. When you see it on stage, it makes perfect sense. But it is a challenging read. Essentially, Peter and the boys are being sold to a king on an island. So they are put on a ship to be sent to an island where they think they are going to be servants to a king. It turns out that they're actually going to be snake food. So while they're on the ship, they find out their true future. And so obviously they are working again, trying to get away from that. We also see Blackstache, who is on an opposite ship. So there are 2 ships on the ocean at the same time. And he is on the ship trying to get a treasure chest. And it turns out that the treasure chest that he thinks is on his ship has been swapped. Mm. And so all it has is sand. He realizes that the ship has, the trunk has been swapped, so now he has to go after the ship that the boys are on their way to this island. So we have a wonderful chase sequence at the end of Act One where they are trying to get the right trunks on the right ship. We have the boys who find out what their fate is. We also meet a girl named Molly, who is just on board the ship for safety. Her father is on the opposite ship. And he finds out that she is now in trouble because the pirates are chasing down the ship to get the trunk. And this sounds very confusing and very convoluted, and it is. But as an audience member, I think the story is very clear. But it does take you on a wonderful, interesting journey of who's where, when. And what makes it even more complicated is every single actor on the stage plays more than one character. And we either know that they are a different character. So, you know, Black Stash, we find out eventually will be Hook, but he's playing a pirate in disguise. Or we just have actors who are cast in multiple roles. And that's the way the show is written. So, yes, what you read online is very convoluted. And it's very hard to kind of sum up. But it's a journey onto an island, which we find out that island is going to become Neverland. And the boys on the ship with Peter are going to become his lost boys. We find out how Hook becomes Hook after this big chase to the island. We also find out Molly's storyline, which kind of aligns with Wendy. So it all aligns beautifully throughout the course of the play. And if you're familiar with Peter Pan, you're going to see those moments of, I get it now. Oh, I bet that's so-and-so later. And we find out how the crocodile came to be. So all these wonderful kind of how on earth get answered throughout the play. So it's really exciting.
Fantastic. I want to ask Evan about the character of Peter, and Cara, please feel free to chime in since you have been Peter Pan yourself. So Evan, this iconic character and also really kind of quirky character, it must be a very special and wonderful challenge to portray somebody like that. I mean, a character that we all know so well and yet don't probably perfectly understand. What kind of a challenge has it been for you to wrestle with Peter Pan?
It was definitely a little bit challenging coming into the show because this is the point where Peter Pan isn't exactly Peter Pan yet, so he's not this happy-go-lucky guy yet. He's very, like, somber, and he's just kind of not happy with how his life is going. But then through the events of the play, you kind of start to see him develop into what's going to become Peter Pan. And you see, like, little character traits where you're like, oh, yeah, I recognize that. And
So when he's sad, are you feeling like you need to still have who Peter Pan is sort of beneath the surface? Or do you get to play him sort of straight sad and then have him evolve into this character we recognize?
I try to play him pretty straight and then have those moments where he starts to evolve as a character. And I think it's working out pretty well so far.
Cool. Cara, what is it like for you to see this character that you know from the inside out at a very different point in his own arc where he's, in effect, not the character that you portrayed on the stage? That must feel a little strange, I should think.
I actually love it. The fact that he has such a great storyline behind him. I think that most of the Broadway production is very happy-go-lucky. It's, you know, a lot of spunk, maybe a little anger, a lot of that kind of energy. But most of the other productions that I've seen, including like the movie Hook and that kind of thing, and even some children's theater productions, we do see that melancholiness and that bitterness that he has for being left alone. And it's heartbreaking to think, you know, there's also the points in these other stories, not necessarily this one, where he says, I went home and looked in the window and there was another little boy in my place. And I think that's a beautiful starting point for where this story starts, because he keeps saying, I hate adults. They lie. They say something and they lie. They don't come through. And so it's kind of taking on that storyline of we see this boy looking through the window and his whole entity is changed because of that, which is a really cool concept on top of just this boy who won't grow up. We see why he doesn't want to grow up.
Right. He doesn't want to become one of those adults.
Absolutely.
Right. He dreads the thought, I should think. Cool. Nick Cicerelli, you are Black Stash. You are a bad guy. We hate your guts, or at least to some extent. So first of all, what's it like to play a villain? And what are maybe some of the special challenges that are involved in taking on a character who provides a lot of the darkness in this work?
Sure. It's fun. I mean, that's really, once you get down to it, it's fun to be the villain. I feel in a lot of plays in general, the villainous characters get a little bit more flexible room to kind of to be a little bit more extraordinary. And Hook to me is a villain that we've always kind of like as well. Even in any iteration, he's got faults and he's, you know, there's a little bit of silliness to him, whether that be the novel, whether that be Hook, whether that, you know, Dustin Hoffman's portrayal of it or anything, you know. He's always kind of likable in his wicked ways. And so it's fun. It's fun to find that likability in a character that is doing something that's so unlikable to try to make him, you know, have the audience enjoy that character as well. So I've enjoyed that immensely. He's a villain, of course. His intent is pretty malicious, but it's still there are reasons why, and I think the play actually explains pretty clearly, you know, what he is after and why he is after it. He wants to be a villain, but he needs a hero, you know, in order to be a villain. So he's on a hunt, for jewels and all this other stuff is great, but a hero is really what he's seeking out as well. So, you know, and he can find that in Peter eventually.
Have you played other villains before this?
I have, yeah. I played a few in my time. And as a high school teacher, I think I play one almost every other day. So, I get used to it's always fun playing the bad guy as compared to the good guy.
So you're used to being booed and spat
about. Yeah, exactly.
No,
absolutely.
Okay, I'm happy for you. Kara, this is, I understand, not just a straight play, but involves a bit of music. I'm not sure we should call it a musical, I didn't think so.
It's a play with music. So there are probably about four or five songs that are just put in to keep the action moving. One is there just strictly for comedy. It could be taken out of the show. We'd never miss it. But we as the cast would miss it because it's a really fun moment. And that's all I'm actually going to say about it. But, you know, there's a sailor song at the beginning. So that makes perfect sense that these characters would be out and singing and chant and that kind of thing as they do their work. So that helps move the character along. We have, you know, some little love songs between the comic characters. We have a lovely song from a mother character, that kind of thing. So they're just little snippets that just are very much character-oriented. Mm.
I know from a little help I gave you with the soundtrack that there are also all kinds of really intriguing, even bewildering sound effects that are just woven through the whole thing, just kind of a tapestry. I'm fascinated to see how that all works with the play.
It's really fun. The play is actually usually done with kind of a live orchestra or just a pianist and a percussionist. And so some of the notes, they give you extensive notes for this production that you can follow or, you know, work independently. And some of what I was reading is they were kind of experimenting throughout the rehearsal process. And so all of a sudden they would kind of play a chord here to accent a movement. And so if you're not doing that movement, you may not use that sound. So it was very much to accent one particular production. And then you use it and you can add and you can take away and just to make your production your own. So I think that we have some more quote-unquote realistic sounds that they may not have used, but we also don't have a live orchestra or a live musician set to play for us. So it was kind of, all right, what do we take from what they've given us, and then what do we still need in order to keep the story moving forward?
Right. Intriguing. I love the look of the set, and somebody was telling me that it's not just cool as I saw it, but apparently through the course of the play, elements of it move around and so on. So the set itself is almost like a living entity or organism.
It's a beautiful playground. Stephen Barnes designed it for us, and it's gorgeous and so much fun to play on. And one of the nice things is we had it very early. So during the blocking process, we were actually up on it. So instead of saying, at this point, you're going to be 10 feet in the air and it's going to be rotating and that kind of thing, we actually could play on it and see what could the set do for us to be integrated into the show, which is really fun.
Fantastic. Yeah, and very rare. Not just here, but in just about any place. Evan, I'm curious, this is your first show with the Racine Theater Guild, although I know you were in a Packy play that was kind of co-production of sorts with Horlick, where you are a student. You'll be a senior there. Does this feel like a different experience from the various plays that you've been in at school? Does this feel any different, or does it feel kind of the same?
It was definitely nerve-wracking coming into an audition because it was kind of like, okay, I'm not comfortable here. I have to kind of get into it a little bit. And then once the rehearsal process started, it was a little different. It didn't take too much getting used to. I would say most of it was pretty similar, but there were definitely some parts of it that were a little different that I think I caught on to pretty quickly.
Right. For one thing, you're probably not used to playing opposite adults. I mean, typically you're in casts that are all young people, and even if you have characters that are supposed to be adults and older, they're being played by your peers. So what's it been like to share the stage with some really talented adult actors?
It's definitely really cool to act with people who have been doing this for a while and people who have been doing this for 10 years or so. And it's really cool just to see, like, the little lessons they can kind of teach you through their movements and, like, just how they speak sometimes. Mm. Just like, oh, when they talk as this character, they tend to enunciate this instead of this. And it's just, like, little traits that could help me as an actor in the future.
Hmm. Great idea. Nick, I'm curious to hear from you what it's like as a director to be directed. That is to be on the other side of the transaction. I mean, obviously, during the school year, you're the person sitting in the chair saying, that wasn't right.
Yeah.
And suddenly you have somebody else telling you that wasn't right. I'm curious about what you think this experience has been like for you. And I suspect it's kind of an interesting quandary that most theater teachers find themselves in when they get on the stage.
Yeah, I think that's the question I've been asked the most is, you know, as a director, how is it as an actor as well? And my training is primarily first in acting before it was directing. And you kind of just know that's your responsibility as an actor, what your responsibilities are as an actor and what your responsibilities are as a director. I'm lucky enough to be able to turn that off. Trust me, the summer break is a summer break for me. So directing, you know, it's not what I want to be doing this summer. I would rather be acting. I don't want to worry about the responsibilities, all of them, that go along with directing. So it's a pleasure to be directed in that response. And I honestly learn a ton from every director that I work with and am able to turn that over and use it when I communicate with students, you know, how certain different rehearsal methods, different communication methods, just it's a learning experience for me. It's like my own in-service over the summer and any other time that I've worked with other directors as well. It's always a learning experience, and that's always positive. So it's good. I think it's healthy as a director to be directed occasionally because you get stuck in your method of doing things all the time, and it helps to kind of expand your mind to other possibilities.
Right. And it's funny, it hadn't even dawned on me that, I mean, someone else in your position might feel tempted to take Evan aside once in a while and give him some thoughts on this and that. And it's just interesting to hear you say that's like the last thing you would do because you have set that director thing aside. Right?
You know, I would be furious if I was directing a show and one of the actors pulled another actor aside and decided to give their advice. I mean, that would drive me nuts.
Right.
We're always very clear about that. You know, please don't give direction to other people. And that's not my job here. You know, my job is to do to build this character and to perform it as well as I possibly can.
So. And to be hated.
And to be hated, yeah, exactly.
And I hear you're accomplishing that really well.
Well, great. So.
And I hear that everybody's falling in love with Evan. So, yeah. So, Kara, the show opens tomorrow night and runs just 2 weekends. And it sounds like, in terms of the technical challenges that are part of this show, lots has come together. Can you just say a quick word about some of the technical challenges that have been part of mounting this?
Well, the first one is the set. Just from the moment that we started designing it, it was how far do we go, how far do we not go, what can it actually do, and it's actually been really nice and flexible for us. We have a relatively new costume designer, Erin Barnland. I want to say this is her first like kind of solo gig on one of a bigger production like this. And the costumes are gorgeous. We were out on stage the other day, and we finally had lights, we had costumes, the set was kind of behaving, and it was really fun to look at. So it's just, it's a really a treat for the audience to look at. So the elements are coming together. We have some wonderful, we have a prop designer. She's a teacher out at Union Grove, Kim Sandberg, who's done some really fun things with our props and some innovative things that I never would have dreamed. It said, you know, can you do this magical thing for me? And she's like, sure. And she comes back and it's there. So I've said it in many different venues, and I say it in personal conversation as well. We have a dream cast and crew. As far as people are just coming in, sharing their energy, sharing their talents, sharing their creativity. And it's been nice to kind of sit back and just direct traffic. Everybody's come in and they've kind of known what they've wanted to do, and it's, yes, that'll work, great, no, let's tweak it, and just, hey, everybody go out and do your job. And it's been really fun. The music has been a challenge, trying to make it work. We're still timing things and getting things to work. Lighting is a big challenge. We have a relatively new lighting designer, but she's wonderful. So it's, and just working in our space because it's a thrust stage.
Right.
Lighting is such a challenge because of the shadows, because of making sure that everybody is seen, making sure that we have the right angles going on. So that's been a huge challenge because I want to say this is probably one of the biggest summer shows we've done in a really long time.
I was going to say,
cast,
sure seems like it.
Production, costumes, crew. I'm not used to working with this many people over the summer. Usually
that's
it's
right.
A lot quieter.
Sure, maybe two performers, three, four.
Right, and a couple crew members backstage doing 6 or 7 different jobs. Otherwise, they're doing nothing throughout
the
course.
Yeah, this is Aida or
but
like
it's
Miss.
Wonderful. It's so cool to have, you know, this many people living in the theater during the summer. It's
fantastic.
So fun.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of people are excited about this. Peter and the Star Catcher opens tomorrow night, and it runs just this weekend and the following weekend. So people need to get on the stick in terms of getting tickets. RacineTheater.org is the website. 633-4218 is the phone number for the box office. And, Kara, thank you so much for spending time to talk about this production. And Evan and Nick as well, our Peter and Blackstash. Great to meet both of you, and best wishes with the run of Peter and the Starcatcher.
Thank you.
I'm Gregory Byrne.
And part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Anyone who is a musician or a music teacher and who wonders about the miracle of making music, and anyone who cares about educating our young people and the most effective ways to do that is sure to find all kinds of things to enjoy in a remarkable new book called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations.
This is the story of an extraordinary music teacher, a public music teacher by the name of Jerry Kupchinski, known affectionately as Mr. K, born in Ukraine, and he came to America with a mission to make the young people he worked with the finest musicians they could possibly be, with unwavering relentlessness and devotion to that task. This book about him has been co-written by two of his students, one of them his daughter, Melanie Kupchinski, a brilliantly talented violinist who plays with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The other author to whom I'm going to be speaking today is Joanne Lippman, who is a highly regarded journalist and has done all kinds of award-winning work for Portfolio, The Wall Street Journal, and she has supervised Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage at The Wall Street Journal. She has been a frequent commentator on public radio, on CNN. Her work has appeared in Newsweek, New York Times, and she has done a wonderful job of helping to bring to life this memorable figure in her own life, her own string teacher, Jerry Kupchinski. Again, this book is called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations, published by Hyperion. And Joanne Lippman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And I love what's said in the foreword of the book, that if Mr. K wasn't a real-life character, somebody would have had to invent him. And he does certainly resonate on the page as almost a figure out of a novel or a figure out of some great film. But instead, he was a flesh-and-blood man who influenced so many lives so powerfully, including your own. One of the things that's what's interesting about your perspective versus that of his daughter, Melanie, is that she has gone on to use music in her professional life and was a brilliant prodigy right from the start. Your own relationship to music, discovery of your own talents, was a much more, shall we say, checkered experience. And, of course, you've gone on to a professional life that really hasn't included music to any meaningful full degree. Just talk for a moment about the interesting contrast between you and your co-author and what that felt like as you penned this book together.
Right, that's right. So Strings Attached, as you said, it tells the story of this one remarkable music teacher who changed the lives of thousands of students, whether they became musicians or whether they went into other fields. And in that sense, in the larger sense, it really is about the mentors that we all have in our own lives. And I do think that, you know, one of the reasons Strings Attached is resonating with people is because, I mean, he has a remarkable story. He was larger than life and had actually quite a tragic personal story. And the fact that he was able to translate that into a legacy of such joy for his students is quite remarkable. But I think a large reason it's resonating with people is because it reminds them of that person in their own life and how, you know, a great music teacher, like a great soccer coach or a great English professor, teaches you things that go so far beyond the classroom. And so for Melanie and myself, as you said, Melanie is a violinist with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I went on to become a journalist. Yet we found that the lessons that he taught us, things like perseverance and resilience and self-confidence, are all of these qualities that translate no matter what sphere of life you're in. But doing it, as you mentioned, writing the book together was so rewarding, because what we do is we tell his story from two points of view. So we are the same age, Melanie and I. We grew up together. She was a child prodigy violinist, as was her younger sister, Stephanie. And I was just an ordinary student. But Mr. K, when I began taking viola lessons, put us all together in a quartet, and we performed together for our entire childhoods. And so that was like a wonderful experience playing together, and we really learned about the passion, we developed a passion for music and really learned about the bonds that music creates among people who play it together. And the wonderful thing about writing the book was, so Melanie and I had gone our separate ways after high school and really lost touch with each other. And it wasn't until her father's memorial service, which we write about in the book, that we reconnected and started trading these stories about her dad, and realized that, you know, from my point of view, from the whiny student point of view, I saw the tough teacher not understanding or appreciating the difficulties and challenges and tragedies in his own life. And so the way we structure the book is with these two voices, where I tell the kind of outside whiny student perspective, and she tells you exactly the same thing that's going on inside his life, where there's, at the same moment, the kind of tragedies and challenges that he is confronting. Writing the book together felt, as it did when we were children, it felt like a duet. And we hope that it reads that way. It was a really, it was like trading melody and harmony back and forth between each other. It was quite a remarkable experience.
Very nicely put. And yes, I love the fact that we have two different voices that are in harmony with each other, although by no means are they the same voice, nor are they the same perspective. Far from it. There's a humorous photograph of you as a youngster with your two talented sisters. And this is at a point in time when there does not seem to be, at this point, much talent in you. Tell our listeners about that little photograph.
Right. So there's this wonderful photo, and it's because we talk about Melanie, who had a violin put into her hands at the age of 4, and she talks about that. And Melanie was a brilliantly talented violinist. But in Mr. K's world, talent was beside the point. He did not think there was anything, there was no such thing as an untalented child, simply a child who could work harder and focus and be more disciplined. And so when I became his student at the age of 10, I had flamed out. And the photo you're referring to just shows you kind of my lack of talent. It's a photo of myself with my two older sisters, one with her violin. She became a music teacher, actually, a brilliant musician. My middle sister, who's sitting at the piano, who was a brilliant pianist and flute player. And then there's me, where in a ballerina pose, even though I didn't take ballet, because my dad's taking the picture, and, like, it was hopeless. I had no talent. He's like, put your hands over your head so it looks like you're doing something.
Well, eventually, of course, you are united with the viola and with Mr. Kupczynski, and the rest is history in many respects. One of the things that one of you says about, I think it's you at one point in remarking about his approach, is that for Mr. K, there was no such thing as an untalented kid, just a kid who didn't work hard enough. And, of course, if you are teaching music with that perspective, then it's little wonder why Mr. Kupczynski brought such passion and relentless drive to the task. If this was about, in a sense, willing students of limited gifts to do well, there was no other way to do it.
That's right. And he believed in, you know, it was discipline and repetition and practice. My early music books are marked all over with his handwriting in giant block letters that just say, again, 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 which I swear was probably his favorite word, most used word in the English language was again. But it worked, and it was this concept that you can do better. And you know what it translates into? And I think at the end of the day, this is one of the reasons why he was so successful and why Strings Attached is resonating with people, is because, as harsh as he was, what it really boiled down to was optimism. He had boundless optimism, in boundless faith in his students' ability to do better. And it gave us all faith and confidence in our ability to do better. So when I started the viola with him, even though I'd flamed out on the piano and had no, you know, there was no sense I had any talent, I was so determined, and he put no limits on what I could do. It was always, he always had an expectation that I could do better, and I always wanted to do better. And his highest compliment, because he didn't compliment this, his highest compliment would be not bad. And if you got a not bad, you were dancing down the street, and you'd go home, and you'd practice twice as hard. And what it did is it gave us all confidence in ourselves, and that kind of quality of perseverance and self-motivation, all these things that you hear people today saying, you know, kids don't have enough self-motivation because they're guided and told every, you know, and you have the trophies for everyone mentality, so people don't learn how to kind of fail and pick themselves back up again. And those are all qualities that Mr. K taught us, that whether you pursued music or whether you went into some other field, those are the skills you need in life to succeed.
Hmm. Let's give our listeners just a quick little snapshot view of just how scary Mr. K was in rehearsal. I'm thinking, for instance, of one thing that I believe it's you describing when your orchestra was contending with a fiendishly difficult piece, or it was fiendishly difficult for these young musicians, Brahms's Academic Festival Overture. And
yes,
you describe what Mr. K did when he was hearing some kind of wrong note somewhere in the violin section. Explain to our listeners what Mr. K would do in a situation like that.
So if Mr. K heard one wrong note, literally, he would stop the whole orchestra and he would scream, you know, he'd say, "Who is deaf in first violin?" Or sometimes he would say, "Who is idiot who play wrong note?" And it's funny now, but you know, it was slightly terrifying. But he was so hard on us, and he just made us rehearse again and again and again. And certainly, that some of his methods you couldn't get away with, nor would you want to today in today's world. But many of his methods are the research is showing actually he was right. Like a lot of things that we backed away from, because a lot of his methods are things that we kind of think fly in the face of everything we know about education. But in fact, the new research is showing that he was right. Things like repetition and rote, and things like allowing us to fail and pick ourselves back up again, and discipline and being strict. I mean, all of these things the research is now showing are actually the mark of effective teachers, and also they also help the self-esteem and confidence of students, which is sort of counterintuitive.
Sure.
It builds their confidence.
We should say, too, that for as frightening as Mr. K was, in just what you described, there is also some humor in there. I mean, and the book is just full of these wonderful lines that he would throw out about, you know, when he would hear something that caused him dismay. I mean, he wouldn't just say that was bad or that was flat or you're rushing. I mean, he would find some intriguing picture, string together some interesting words, maybe even playing off the fact that English was his second language, to make the point in a way that, you know, even while it was on its surface harsh, there was something a little funny about it, which also probably helped it penetrate. Can you just give our listeners a sense of what I'm talking about there?
Sure. I mean, you know, he would say, he had these very funny sayings, you know, cellos sound like hippopotamus rising from mud in the river. You know, he had these ridiculous things. He had a very funny sense of humor, and he also had a huge heart, which there's a lot of humor in the book, but there's also so much heart. I mean, he would do things. In addition, you know, he was tough on us, but he had such love for the students and such passion for education. So he would do things for us, like, you know, he had us perform all the time, but he would take us to nursing homes and to hospitals to play for the patients, and it really instilled a sense of public service in his students that I think lasted a lifetime. And I also think a lot of it came from his own past. I mean, he, as we mentioned, had this incredibly difficult private life that included a childhood that he never, ever spoke about in Ukraine. And we did a massive amount of research, actually, to find out about his childhood, which it turns out was spent fleeing. I mean, he was born right before World War II, and he spent his entire childhood amid bloodshed and destruction in Ukraine, fleeing from the Russians and the Nazis and the Poles, in refugee camps. He was starved. He was, his entire childhood was a struggle, not just, you know, to survive and also to finish the school year. It was so hard for him to get an education that when he finally came here to the United States, he was already 19 years old. He spoke no English. He'd never had even a music lesson at that point. He loved music, but there was never an opportunity for him to learn music. And so he was so grateful, I think, to be in the United States and have the opportunities he had to learn English, to get educated, to learn music, and then to turn around and teach it to others, that I think that passion just overflowed. He had such gratitude for his life, despite all of its hardships, that just infected all of us. I mean, it really carried over to all of his students.
In spectacular fashion. And I love all the moments in the book when you share moments about sort of his soft, tender side. For instance, an experience where he brought maybe your quartet or some of the young players for the first time to play in a nursing home, and gently explaining to you how some of these older people might want to reach out and actually physically touch you, and that they're not around children often. It would mean so much to them. And I just love that window into the tender corners of his soul, of this guy that was otherwise in so many ways scary to you. I want to finish with a question that has really been on my mind as I have read your wonderful book. I happen to be a teacher of music. I'm in my real life, the rest of the day, I'm a professor of music, a voice teacher, actually. And when I look at the list of sort of principles that guided Mr. K, things like strict is better than nice makes me realize that I'm actually a really nice guy and not all that strict, and that in so many respects, I am poles apart from Mr. K in the way that I teach music. And I'm really struggling with that. And I don't want to make this about me, but I think a lot of music teachers would read this book and react the same way, and particularly public school teachers at this time when the arts are kind of under fire and many of them are treading lightly. There's probably part of them that want to be more like Mr. K. Do you think it's that this is the kind of music teacher he needed to be because this is who he was? Or do you feel like all of us who teach music should be more like Mr. K, even if that's not really who we are when we just sort of roll out of bed and are our natural selves? Would you want music teachers, no matter who we are, to sort of reach deep into ourselves and find our inner Mr. K as we're working with our students? I wonder if you've thought much about that.
Melanie and I thought a lot about this. And I think where we come down is that clearly there's no one size fits all for teaching. And Mr. K's younger daughter, Stephanie, became a teacher who embraced so many of his methods, but she was also incredibly kind, and she was not a yeller at her students. But I think that the bottom line really is, you know, the subtitle of the book, it's Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. And I think that great expectations, that to me is the bottom line, the unifying factor for all of these great teachers is that they inspire and that they expect a lot of their students in the same way Mr. K expected a lot of us. And it showed he had his very strict methods, but I think that great teachers have that belief in their students and the passion for their subject, and those are the things that give the student the confidence they need to succeed, the tools they need to succeed. And it really is, at the end of the day, it's optimism, it's faith in your student's ability. And I don't think you need to be tough necessarily to convey that, but I do think that it does have to do with having high standards and having the belief that your student can meet them.
Very well put. It's a terrific book and a stupendous story. Again, the book is called Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations, published by Hyperion. And the book, by the way, is also full of wonderful and sometimes very poignant photographs that also bring this story to life. And Joanne Lipman, a great pleasure and honor for me to speak with you, and congratulations on an absolutely terrific book.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here with you.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock. You're listening to WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear my interview with Dale Peterson, the author of The Ghosts of Gombe. Gombe refers to a creek in Tanzania on the banks of which Dr. Jane Goodall did some of her really important groundbreaking work in studying chimpanzees in the wild. Dale Peterson looks not only at the work that she did there, but also at kind of the interesting personal dynamics that were there between some of the people who came to Tanzania to do research work with her, and also tries to unravel the mystery surrounding the tragic death of one of those young people who made her way to Tanzania.